Hi everyone, I'm Andy Corbett and welcome to Thriving in Uncertainty, our new weekly podcast where we spotlight leaders who've embraced ambiguity and successfully navigated change. Each episode we'll hear real stories of overcoming challenges, adapting to new realities and thriving through resilience. Join us as we learn from these experiences and gain insights to face our own uncertainties head on. In today's episode, we will discuss innovating in uncertainty with David Thodey. David is a business leader focused on innovation and technology with more than 30 years experience creating brand and shareholder value. David is chair of Xero, chair of Ramsay Healthcare, co-chair of the Great Barrier Reef Foundation and the Climate Leaders Coalition, and chancellor at the University of Sydney. He was previously CEO of IBM Australia and New Zealand, and CEO of Telstra, and has wide experience as a board director, including as a past director of Vodafone Group, CSIRO, CSL, and Telstra. David has a Bachelor of Arts in Anthropology and English from Victoria University of Wellington, and completed the postgraduate general management program at Northwestern University's Kellogg School of Management. He received an honorary doctorate in science from Deakin University in 2016, an honorary doctorate in technology from University of Technology in 2018, and an honorary doctorate in business from University of Sydney in 2022. He was also recognized for his services to business and ethical business leadership with an Order of Australia in 2017. David, it's a pleasure to have you on the podcast today. Thank you for coming on.
Thanks, Andy. It's a pleasure to be with you and looking forward to our discussion.
Excellent. So look, David, we've had quite a few people on the show, lots of public sector leaders discussing this concept of thriving in uncertainty, really getting to the details of how they've gotten comfortable in ambiguity and how they've navigated their way through change. And today I just wanted to talk to you about this concept of innovating in uncertainty or you know, adaptive innovation. The yep. Observatory of Public Sector Innovation describes adaptive innovation as testing and trying new approaches in response to a changing operating environment. So my question for you, David, is, you know, from your perspective, how do we enable an authorizing environment where we trust and empower our people to test and try new ways of doing things?
Well, let me firstly say, Andy, I mean, I think it's a really important topic. And, you know, this whole idea of innovation, but innovation and uncertainty, by the way, I'm still waiting for a period of time when there is uncertainty, but put that aside for a moment. You know, it is, I think, for all of us in our own personal careers, in terms of our own leadership styles, but also in leading departments, agencies, or organizations, driving innovation or change in a world which is changing rapidly around us or therefore has uncertainty is really important. And it's really interesting because I think great leaders are able to really somehow adapt to the ambiguity, the uncertainty that exists around them. And I remember when we were doing the review of the public service back in, what was that, 2018-19, we looked at the sort of different characteristics of leadership in industry versus public sector. And really interestingly, the one quality that was stronger in public sector or people working in civil service attributes of leadership versus industry was the ability to lead in ambiguity. And I think that probably reflects, you know, the nature of the public service, because you are there to do good public policy or execute good policy, but you've always got a political overlay, so therefore you've got a great degree of ambiguity. And also public policy by definition is got a lot of different stakeholders, therefore you're always dealing with a vast complexity of ideas and people with very strong views often coming to you. So you have to be able to hold things, you know, lightly and then really look for clarity of thinking and insight. And I think that really does, you know, relate to this whole question of innovation, because what you're trying to do is to look at the world and where it's going or a particular area, and then find a solution that is going to move the issue forward, you know, in some new way. And I think it is really important that we train our people to be able to do that, whether in public service or in industry. And I do think it's up to leadership to talk about innovation to, you know, really enable that, in, you know, well, empowering or enabling environment. So, you know, it is an interesting observation that, you know, the companies that do that, or the organizations that do that, do deliver better outcomes. And I think that's really what we're all trying to do, is to really, you know, have greater impact. So authorizing environment for innovation, critically important. A couple of other things on it, just before I throw back to you. I can remember at Telstra, which is, you know, it's quite a long time ago now, Andy, but anyway, we really wanted to try to create an environment where people took ownership and really, you know, lent into the challenges, because, you know, a big complex organization like the public service or a department or agency. And we it was both a cultural challenge, i.e. getting people to behave in the right way and take accountability for that innovation, but also you had to put in place systems and processes, because innovation isn't just sort of a random idea. I mean, it takes discipline and rigor, and you have to create an environment that people feel confident to step into, and then processes to look at innovative ideas and then determine what you do with them. And we then called it a, you know, T-Innovate, and we put a process around it for ideation, we put capital behind it, and then actually blessed, you know, innovative ideas. And of course, the other part of that is this question of trust. And trust is a really important element in empowerment, because trust isn't blind faith. Trust is not anarchy. Yeah, trust is very deliberate, and with trust goes accountability. And I think they are the things that some people worry about when they think about this innovative environment and empowering people, that somehow they lose control and risk factors go up. And it's not like that at all. It's actually quite a disciplined process. And yes, there's some elements of risk, but with that goes trust. So I think you've got to get all those things working together, and having this desire to not accept the status quo, to reinvent yourself, you know, look for the truth, look for the constant improvement. You get all that right, and then you do really well. Now, when I talk to this public service, I say, oh, well, David, that's all really, really great. You know, that's your tech speak. But, you know, we live in a world of, you know, public scrutiny and taxpayers' money. And yes, I understand that. But I still think within the guardrails that you have as a public servant, there's enormous opportunity to look at innovative ways of public policy, how we do things, delivering services within Service Australia, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So they're the things that sort of come to mind as you ask me that question around these authorising environments.
And you mentioned trust there and how important that is. I mean, what practical steps do you think leaders could take to build trust and empower their teams?
Yeah, well, it's a good question, Andy, because, you know, it's easier to say, you know, trust. And the reality is many of our organizations are set up anything but a trusting environment. We put more controls, we have processes and things that often mitigate that trusting environment. But let me quickly add there, when you have a trusting environment, there's always the accountability that goes with it. So it is a balance. You know, I mean, if I, even with my children, you know, I trust them until I don't trust them. And then, because if they abuse that trust, then there's a consequence. And I remember one of the values we had at Telstra was trust each other to deliver, trust each other to deliver. And because what we had was an environment where there wasn't a sense of working together and there was mistrust between divisions or, you know, different factions. And one of the things that we had to do was to go and look at whether we had implemented policies that mitigated against trust. Now, I'm going to give you an example here that I'm not sure we can do in the public service, but I'll give you an example which actually came from Netflix. I remember one of the biggest areas that often comes under scrutiny is expenses. Expense management is always a difficult area in any organization. But Netflix took a view to say, look, we're going to trust you on your expenses to treat expenses like it's your own money. So we're not going to ask for you to get approvals for travel, or you don't even have to, you know, submit an expense account. But if we ever find that you've abused the trust that we have set, because they had guidelines on what you could claim, then you're fired. You're fired. And so, and it wasn't, you weren't fired for abusing the expense guidelines. It was because we can't trust you anymore. And I use the example, and we did something similar at Telstra. I use the example because you do need to set up the enabling environment, that you sort of this authorizing environment that does mitigate people to take accountability, and that therefore there is worthiness of trust, and give it people the freedom to go and do things, but within those guardrails. And so you do need to look at policy, because so often we create in organizations environments where we delegate decisions up the line rather than taking accountability for our own actions. And so I think that this whole question of accountability and trust goes together. And if you do that, I think you actually create an environment where people take ownership and really do incredible things, because that's what you want. I mean, all the ideas and breakthrough thinking does not come from, you know, senior leaders. It comes from, you know, people right throughout the organization. And I think that's a really important realization.
Yeah, that's great. And a really good example there that you provided from your time at Telstra. And we're talking about this, these enablers and to support this authorizing environment. What role do you see technology, especially emerging tech, such as AI, playing in doing that?
Well, I mean, technology, innovation, technology change is the major enabler of so much change in our society and industry and public policy. It is it pervades everything. And of course, AI, as of yesterday, DeepSeek, all these changes are happening very quickly. I think digital enablement and the digital underlying of everything that we do is that magic sort of ingredient that's allowing us to do things differently. So I think it's very exciting. I mean, personally, I am a great advocate for Gen AI, but I'm also very conscious that we've had lots of technology changes through the last 30, 40 years. Gen AI is another one. I mean, in one sense, it's nothing new. In another sense, it's radically different. But the whole question of data enablement, big data, because everything's become, has been digitized, then the application of algorithms, and then these large language or small language models over that to interpret the data analytics. I mean, it's just been an obvious outcome, and therefore automation is enabling us to do things radically different. And I see it both in business, in terms of doing things differently, delivering better citizen outcomes through to better efficiency, to new revenue opportunities. But I see it enormously in research and our ability to handle enormous big data sets in a way that and get insights that we never could before. And you're seeing that in biomedical, opportunities, the whole synthetic biology area, but it's applying in social sciences as well, in terms of our ability to understand behaviors. So I think this is really quite a enabling period of time, we'll be able to do things in different ways. And so therefore, we all need to lean into this. So I am a great advocate, but I just see it as a sort of natural progression. And it will continue to get, you know, more efficient, more easily accessible. It'll be embedded in everything we do. And I do think, by the way, just so put on the record, is that we do need guardrails with this. You know, it's because there are some things that we really need to be careful about, because, as you know, data is not pure and algorithms are not pure, and we need to make sure we really understand how we're using these, you know, algorithms as well. But yeah, big advocate for it. Big advocate.
I am too. I think it's going to be game changing, to be honest, for everything that we do, and lead to really good outcomes. And of course, you mentioned there guardrails. Of course, there will be challenges. Do you mind just elaborating on where you think the challenges might be? I mean, particularly from a public sector context as well.
Right. Well, I think we've got to, really make sure that the human element is always in any decision making. Now, if we're talking about, you know, social services, I mean, we can use algorithms to analyze a certain situation and bring up a recommended course of action. I don't think we should go to a point where the algorithm gives the answer. I think it needs to be interpreted within a human context. And I think, so at the moment, I think the guardrails sort of always indicate there should always be some human decision making in the process, and I would absolutely agree with it. But using AI, Gen AI, to analyze a situation with all the history and all the public policy to come up with a set of recommendations, I think is really great. I mean, that saves an enormous amount of time, gives sort of greater consistency, but it does need a human element over it. I think there's ethical issues. Just because it's possible doesn't make it the right thing to do. And when you start thinking through some of the aspects of research, it's like genetic engineering. We have a caveat on any human embryo work. And even though that was abused in one place, I think those standards, like we do in any scientific research, we need to have those guardrails where it's saying to step across a ethical boundary that we as a society don't want to do. So I think they are the sorts of things that we need to be vigilant about as we, see the power of this technology taking place. But it is going to happen. It is happening. And we got to lean in. I mean, an interesting one, as an aside, Andy, I mean, at the University of Sydney, as a number of other universities are doing, I mean, we're encouraging the use of Gen AI. Absolutely. We want the students to be well versed in using multiple, generative AI products, but want them to have that critical thinking and judgment and discernment across what those algorithms are actually presenting, because they don't always give you the right answer. I mean, I've asked, a couple of, those Gen AI products answers, questions, and given me, absolute trash. So we've got to make sure that we're training people to use it and use it in the right way. So, and recognize if you're going to use Gen AI to rewrite a paragraph of an essay, say, yeah, I use Gen AI to do this. That's fine. If it's clearer and better, that's okay. So I think we've got to really work through all these things and have really strong transparency on it, so we get to a better outcome for everyone.
Yeah, like you say, we need to embrace it. It's here to stay. So we've got to just figure out how to actually work with it and to achieve these better outcomes, for sure.
Yeah.
And we touched on this idea of failure earlier, we're speaking about innovation throughout this episode. How would you actually define the relationship between innovation and failure? I mean, I just know from some of the people that we've come across with the work that we do, people are quite scared of failure. They don't necessarily want to be fail? Like, what? How would you define that relationship, do you think?
Yeah. Well, I mean, they're the two sides of the same coin, aren't they, Andy? I mean, it's to innovate means you've got to push the boundaries and in your thinking or in what you're working on, and with that comes risk of failure. And look, I don't think any of us like failing. You know, I mean, I don't like failing. I like to be successful. But I think that what, you know, it's that mindset of using failure as a learning opportunity to improve. And when you think around the scientific method, I mean, the whole principle of discovery is you do an experiment 1,000 times until it fails, and then you learn something new. So that's how it works. And I mean, even if you look at your astronomy, you know, you have hypotheses until you prove them wrong. And so I think it is an inherently part of life and our own experiences, because even as children, you know, when you're learning to walk or you're learning to do something, you learn through failing, falling over, or touching something that's hot, you know, all those things. So I think it's a very natural human process, but doesn't make it necessarily pleasant. And I think that's what people react to. So I think that's the attitude you've got to come to at creating an environment of innovation where failure is just a part of it, but it's not, maybe we shouldn't use the word failure, maybe a learning opportunity, because that's really what it is. And so they just go hand in hand. And now the big one is in business or in public services, you know, don't fail on the same issue twice, you know? So, you know, yeah. You want to learn from it. You know, you don't want to go back and, you know, keep repeating the failure. Sometimes you actually do in experimentation, but yeah, so I think that would be what I would say. But yeah, there was a lot of people have said to me over the years, oh, well, you know, Australians are risk averse and don't like failure. Yeah, and you know, the US, I mean, especially the tech industry, they talk about, you know, that the failure is just until you've failed in a couple of startups, you haven't really lived. Look, I'm not sure. I think Australians are actually quite good risk takers. And I don't think they've got any greater fear of failure than others. I mean, when you look at what we've done in the mining sector, you know, we've had enormous people betting their whole lives on exploring, you know, for minerals. And I think we're pretty rational. We go to where there is, you know, the risk is and the reward are related. So I think we need to not talk ourselves down, but say, hey, yeah, we can do this and get on with it. But yeah, failure is a part of that innovative journey, I think.
Absolutely. And like you say, there's been so many great examples, I think, in Australia as well, where they've embraced that. So I agree. Yeah. I completely agree with you, David. And before you referenced as well your 2019 review of the APS.
Yeah.
In that particular review, you sought to understand the APS operating environment in 2030 through scenario planning. And unbelievable now, 2030 is only 5 years away. So time's flying very quickly. Sorry, 2030 is only 5 years away. And we've already seen various elements of all of these scenarios come to light.
Yeah.
So I guess one scenario that we couldn't really predict or foresee that draws from these was COVID-19. How do you think we went in terms of responding to the pandemic, do you think?
Look, I think we did as well, if not slightly better, than many countries around the world. I mean, the challenge is that every country had its own set of challenges. I remember, I was on an advisory group to the PM, and I brought an industry perspective to that period. And look, it wasn't perfect, and you know, the reviews that have been done said we could have been a little bit faster on a few areas. We probably could have moved on a few vaccines a bit faster. But, you know, within the context of what we had dealt to us, I think Australia did pretty well. And we came out pretty quickly. We've had higher inflation coming out of COVID, as we've just, but there's been a lot of factors impacting, you know, the inflationary pressure. So in general, I give us a tick. You know, our loss of life was reasonably low compared to other country standards. The vaccination process actually worked pretty well. I mean, we had some extreme views out there, but in general, I think we got the vaccines out pretty quickly. You know, there's obviously been the global supply chain issue where we didn't have enough masks, we didn't have enough ventilators, but you know, it was amazing to see how people came together to address those concerns. We had some challenges in equity across the whole country, and we had some communities more isolated, and that took a while for us to work through. Federation was challenging because you remember we had those state border issues, and moving goods between states was a challenge, but we got through it all. What I feel very pleased about is, you know, being an Australian and seeing how, you know, people rallied together and supported each other at a community level. I mean, in the face of great tragedy and challenge, I mean, Australians do rally together, and I think it's a great characteristic. And the one other great benefit was we saw, you know, greater collaboration across the public service and public service to industry than we've seen at other times, because we're all in the same boat. So there were some good things that came out of it. And, you know, but within the whole context of the APS review, look, it's always challenging to do these reviews because it's very hard to predict the future. But, you know, this whole question about creating organisations that are adaptable, that have good leadership across the big changing dynamics, that's what we need the public service to do, because it's impossible to predict what the future will hold. So there's a few reflections.
And yeah, absolutely. And you mentioned it just then. One of the things that stood out as well was this idea of government agencies working together, collaborating across those boundaries to really to respond well. That's shown in history that's the case in emergencies such as the pandemic. What lessons do you think we can draw from the pandemic for that particular situation to apply moving forward so that we can tackle whole of government problems and collaborate together? What do you think are the standout key takeaways from the pandemic?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's pretty simple in my thinking, but simple to explain, but not necessary to do. When you have a common problem and that's sitting in front of you that impacts us all, it's a lot easier to collaborate. And therefore, you know, sometimes you get something external like a global pandemic, but when you don't have a global pandemic, it's got to be based around a common vision of what we're trying to achieve as a nation. And when you, I mean, be it in a team environment, organization, state, community, or a nation, if you have a common vision about where you're going and what you want to jointly achieve that transcends personal parochial interest, you get collaboration. It's very hard to say to you and me, Andy and David, go and be good team players. Well, you say, well, maybe. What do you want me to do? But if you say to you and me, say, David and Andy, I want you to go and do X, Y, Z that inspires us both, then we'll get on and do it and we'll be great teammates. So it's a very simple explanation, but I think it is the truth. So if you say to me, how do we make the APS work better together? Well, it's about having a vision for this country that, you know, is about creating, you know, a better standard of living for all our people, about active communities. It's about creating value in the environment, socially, economically. That's what brings people together. Now, we'll all argue about quite the how, but that's what we need. And therefore you need good leadership. And we get good leadership, then you watch, people will work together. Now, the Westminster system, and in the way our political system works and the public service, and we have ministers and departments and they have their views, but we've always got to keep, we need a leader who can bring us together on what we can create and where Australia sits in the global environment. Then we get collaboration.
Yeah, brilliant. And I think that's the fundamental component, right? We have to start there and then the how follows, really.
Yeah, it really does. Yeah.
And David, I'd just like you to get your crystal ball out now for a moment and just look ahead to 2040 and beyond.
Yeah.
What are the scenarios do you foresee and how do organisations need to adapt and organise their workforce now to be in a position to respond to these better when and if those particular scenarios arise?
Yeah. Well, this is always a hard question. I mean, I think probably you've got to say, look, none of us really know what 2040 will hold for us. But the one thing we do know is it'll be radically different to what it is in 2025. And therefore, as you look to the future, you've got to keep focusing on what the workforce you have, the agility and the flexibility of the workforce to adapt and change. I mean, who would have picked COVID? You know, I mean, we didn't pick COVID in the APS. We didn't, you know, the black swan event. But there'll be other black swan events for sure. You watch. There are certain trends around technology. We know technology will continue to, you know, drive innovation and change. And the thing about technology, it isn't just technology for technology's sake. It's about what it does in research, what it does to enable different business models. I mean, who would have predicted, you know, the changes that happened around a search engine like Google that completely upended advertising and media? I mean, that was, it could never happen without technology. So these things are going to continue to come at us. I think automation, you know, be it through Gen AI, robotics, process re-engineering, that's going to continue to happen. So I think seeing these big trends and then creating a workforce that is flexible enough to respond and change and adapt and not hold on to the past too long. Because when you hold on to the past, it's like a company, you know, it's like, you know, if you keep doing what you did yesterday, there's no guarantee of success for the future. So you need to have this ability to reinvent yourself and drive and look for innovation and change. They are the characteristics I think any workforce needs to have. And if you do that, then no matter what comes at you, whether it's political change, environmental change, social change, economic change, then you'll be able to be flexible. But you have to be, you know, diligent, rigorous, and constantly looking at it. And then I think that's what, you know, protects you from becoming extinct or redundant in many ways.
Absolutely. We don't know what's going to happen, but if you've got the key ingredients in place, at least it gives you a standing chance of being able to adapt to whatever does happen. So, great answer there, Dave. Thank you. And we're actually approaching the end of the episode now, but a question that we like to ask our guests before they go is just whether there's a leader or an influencer, whether it's one person or many, that have inspired you professionally. And if that's the case, who are they and why, David?
Yeah, well, it's always an interesting question, this one, and I tend to answer it a little bit backhanded way. Look, there's many, many, many people who I've appreciated as great leaders, from people who are well known to, you know, relatives to friends to, you know, to people that, you know, have no recognition at all. And, you know, I mean, I look at Bezos, you know, and what's happened with Amazon. I mean, what an incredible story and his rigor and discipline and, you know, what he did. Or I look at, you know, someone like well, you know, Satya Nadella at Microsoft, who's completely, you know, changed the culture there and reinvented it and moved it into Azure. You know, the sort of, what would I say for Steve Jobs, you know, his ability to bring together a user experience that was, you know, unique. You know, I look at Church. I mean, there's lots of people I look at. But I think the attitude that great people have is they're always learning from other people. It doesn't matter who it is, you know, from, and you can always learn something from someone else because of their life experience, because of their insights. And if you have that learning spirit and that willingness to look for greatness and look for the best in people, knowing that not everyone is perfect, you know, and by any means, then that's what I think really creates an environment where we're all on a journey together to improve and make a difference and move the world forward. And so there's no one person I say, oh, that's the ultimate, you know, perfect leader. But there's many, many people that I've learned from and continue to learn from. And it's a life journey. It's a life, you know, long pursuit of, you know, continuing to improve yourself. So if we have that attitude, then I think we all will be better off for it.
Absolutely. Love that answer. Thank you, David. And thank you as well for coming on the podcast today, sharing your insights with us. I'm sure all of our listeners will take away a long, long, long list of practical tips that they can go away and apply in their own role. So hopefully it's very beneficial for those guys. And yeah, thanks once again for being part of today's conversation.
My pleasure, Andy, and well done. Great subject, and keep talking about it, because in talking about it, that's where we get insights. So thank you. All the best.
We hope you enjoyed listening today. This episode is now available to download from our website, which is www.corbettprice.com.au/podcast. That's www.corbettprice.com.au/podcast. Join us next week for another episode as we spotlight our next leader in this inspiring series on thriving in uncertainty. Thank you for listening. Goodbye.